That's Master Ghetto and band leader and salsa singer Poncho Sanchez, one of my favorites, with Señor Blues. This is Lead Stories. I'm Yatrice Lead, and a program I hope you will find some value in today. If you say Cinco de Mayo, which is what today is, to the average American, you'd probably be asked, where is the party? True, it is a celebration, but the advertising world and the mainstream media have all but erased its historical significance. Most people associate Cinco de Mayo with after-work bar crawls and copious amounts of tequila and beer and guacamole. Cinco de Mayo commemorates this day in 1862 when an outnumbered, outgunned Mexican army repelled French invaders in the Battle of Puebla. Oddly, the event goes practically unnoticed in Mexico and is more celebrated in the United States, particularly in California and Texas. Dr. David Hayes Bautista, author of El Cinco de Mayo, An American Tradition, and professor of medicine and director of the Center for the Study of Latino Health and Culture at UCLA's School of Medicine, explains the connection between Cinco de Mayo and the abolition of slavery in the United States, the Civil War, the Declaration of Independence, and most importantly, the Indo-Afro-Iberio-Americano sociopolitical achievements already made long before English settlers founded Jamestown, Virginia in 1607 and Plymouth, Massachusetts in 1620. I'd like to share with you this snapshot of El Cinco de Mayo so we can appreciate how people have been essentially robbed of a very authentic understanding of this holiday. So I present to you Dr. David Hayes Bautista.
How many of you got a chance to see that PBS series, Latino Americans, last night? I haven't. They had me working. They took me out to dinner last night, so I didn't get a chance to see it. But I do want to cover some ground, but maybe from a health perspective. You know, there's just been a lot of demographic changes, and not everybody is always comfortable with them. This was an irate letter to the editor that was sent in to the Los Angeles Times, which might give us a sense of how some people feel about things. Now, let me just read this to you. He said, "I rushed my son to the emergency room at Huntington Memorial." It's a big LA area hospital. "I was one of the few English-speaking people there. I was handed a clipboard. The papers were in Spanish. I had to flip every page over to get the English version." You can tell he is not a happy camper. So he comes to his immediate conclusion. "If anyone has a doubt about the cost of illegal immigration, I suggest that he spend a few minutes in any emergency room at any hospital and witness firsthand what is going on there." Now, my question is, what was going on there? What was he seeing? What was he witnessing? Well, he didn't realize it because he doesn't know a lot about American history. He was witnessing 500 years of Latino health and medicine in what's now the United States. Yes, 500 years. Well, probably this irate gentleman, when he went to high school history, was told that the United States began at Jamestown in 1607. And they always say that, you know, where America began, the birth of America, Jamestown, et cetera, et cetera. But you know, 81 years before Jamestown, Latinos were here. The first settlements based on Western society and values. In fact, the very first one, 1526, San Miguel de Guadalupe, that was founded by Lucas Vasquez de Ayón. Actually, they're Dominicanos. They left Puerto Plata with 600 people and went up to San Miguel de Guadalupe in Georgia. And that was the first settlement. I mean, people, businesses, houses, etc. But they didn't look like the folks that went to Jamestown 81 years later. Now, the folks who went to Jamestown were British, Protestant, etc. The folks that went to San Miguel de Guadalupe, yes, came out of Western society, but a different variant that had Iberian roots to it, that had indigenous roots to it, had African roots to it, and even Asian roots to it. So it was American, but a different kind of American that, in fact, Carlos Fuentes, I think, has created the best term for this, Indo-Afro-Ibero-America. Okay, all of our roots. Indo-Afro-Ibero-America. Now, that settlement, San Miguel de Guadalupe, was not the only one. It was the first one, but you had a whole host of these, followed shortly by Santa Maria de Ochuse, 1559, founded by Tristan de Luna in Florida. Then it was such a great location, they put together the first fort in Pensacola. Yeah, it's now the Pensacola Marine Air Station. You know, we have missions out here in the West. You got missions here in Texas. Did you realize they had missions in Florida? The first school in Georgia was taught by the Jesuits and was taught in Spanish in Georgia. Hello. And, of course, St. Augustine, 1565. I mean, look at that huge fort. I mean, it's not like they were just there for a weekend and were going to be gone. They were there for good. You had Spanish-speaking settlements all up the coast of Georgia. You had Spanish-speaking settlements all up the coast of South Carolina, including the one that's really getting a lot of research now, founded by Pedro Menendez de Avila. It was called Santa Elena. It's in Paris Island. It's now the Marine Station. They've been really reconstructing life there. And then, here's the big shocker. You know how we're always told that Manhattan was founded by the Dutch? Remember they bought it for 24 bucks or something? 7 years before the Dutch, a Dominicano, a Latino, actually founded the first settlement in what came to be Manhattan. Juan Rodriguez, Dominicano, Indo-Afro-Ibero-Americano. And this Indo-Afro-Ibero-America was spread all across the continent, in the Mississippi Valley, came up through here on the way up to New Mexico. And in fact, in the entrada that Juan de Oñate made, which was a fascinating entrada, I know as you go further up north in New Mexico, they talk about the Spanish. Well, Juan de Oñate, okay, he was of Spanish origin. I don't know if they tell you that his wife was Isabel Moctezuma. Yeah, from that Moctezuma, which means their kids were mestizos. Okay, Indo-Afro-Ibero-America. But in that first entrada came the first medical library into what's now the United States. And it was this library is unpacked at San Juan de los Caballos, just right north of Santa Fe. Now, we don't know the books that were in it, but because of the meeting of medical cultures back in 1492, particularly in Mexico beginning in 1521, there is a huge industry, particularly in Mexico, of Spanish-trained physicians looking at indigenous medicine and say, oh my God, they discovered stuff I didn't even know existed. So there's a whole host of books being published in Mexico. The Secrets of Surgery is being published here in Mexico. It could have been this summary and compilation of surgery, again published in Mexico, 1578. Could have included Dr. Agustin Farfán's 1578 book published in Mexico City. Brief treatise on medicine, Tratado Breve de Medicina. It could have been Dr. Juan de Cárdenas' Marvelous Secrets of the Indies, again published in Mexico City, as they're trying to figure out all this stuff about indigenous medicine. Or Gregorio López's A Treasury of Medicines, also published in Mexico City. We don't know exactly which books were in there. Could have been all of them. Could have been something else. This was a huge industry, but the first medical library in what's now the United States didn't arrive at Jamestown. It arrived right through here in the West. In fact, the first infirmary was founded in San Felipe, further up north, 1625. And of course, you had medical folks back and forth. One of them used to function around here. Cristobal Larrañaga brought the first smallpox vaccinations up through here, and he had colleagues going out through California as well. So you had people here, right here in El Paso. You had Spanish-speaking population in Arizona. You had Indo-Afro-Ibero-America in California. In fact, they laid the foundations of medicine in California. The very first university-trained, licensed medical provider in California stepped ashore with Father Serra, and he was the naval surgeon, Pedro Prat. And he had the policy mission to create the health infrastructure for the folks, settlers who are coming up from northern Mexico. The oldest medical license I've been able to find in California is this one, some of the Bancroft Archive. It's dated 1799. There, see, 1799. But it wasn't issued in Baltimore. It wasn't issued in Boston. It wasn't issued in New York. It was issued in Mexico City by the Proto Medicato, the Board of Medical Examiners. It had been established in 1529. And it was a license to actually go up to Alta California and practice medicine. So by 1800, about two-thirds of what's now the United States actually had been based on Indo-Afro-Ibero-American version of Western society. So I don't know if they were including all of this last night. I don't know if they talked about any of this stuff. But this is way before Jamestown. There was already stuff going on here. I know, but some of you can say, but that was so long ago, 200 years ago. They're all dead and gone. Nothing of that remains now. Or does it? What do we have to remind us of that? Well, let me give you something to remember. Every time somebody says, you guys just got here, blah, blah, blah. Think of this. That's Cinco de Mayo. Now, I bet you guys had a big Cinco de Mayo here in El Paso last May, right? And if you're like most places, actually probably the festivity started about a week before and went about a week after. Isn't that great? It's probably the best known Latino celebration in the United States. But have any of you ever been in Mexico on a Cinco de Mayo? What happens in Mexico? Very little, almost nothing. Outside of Puebla, almost nothing. Okay. So here is the mystery of the ages. Why is the Cinco de Mayo celebrated so much in the United States if it's not that celebrated in Mexico? Ever stop to consider that? Yes, there is wisdom in this. Now, I know we're all very busy, so let me give you the 30-second version. So if some of you have to go back to your lab, you can in 30 seconds. Here is the mystery of the ages. We need to understand that to begin with, Cinco de Mayo is not a Mexican holiday. Because if it were, they'd celebrate all over Mexico, no? And our celebrations here would just be pale imitations of what they do in Mexico. But it's just the reverse. We do it up big here. And people in Mexico scratch their heads saying, that's not Mexican Independence Day. Right, okay. So if it's not a Mexican holiday, what is it? It is an American Civil War holiday created by Latinos here in the American West to celebrate the stances that Latinos took on the issues of the American Civil War. I'm seeing some puzzled looks. What? Civil War? You guys weren't even here yet. Oh, yeah. And because we were here, we not only have the Cinco de Mayo, we actually have civil rights in this country. Civil rights? You guys weren't on the East Coast. Well, let's talk about civil rights. Let's go back to 1776, right? Birthplace of America is supposed to be Jamestown. Then 1776, it finally gets its independence. And of course, we talk about this every 4th of July, the Declaration of Independence. They had some really interesting, valuable goals that people were fighting for. And you read the Declaration of Independence, it says so very nicely, all men are created equal, and they are endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Hey, that's pretty good. I'd fight for that. So they fought their war. By the way, you had a lot of Latinos involved in the American Wars of Independence. In many battles, there were more soldiers that spoke Spanish than spoke English fighting for American independence. And I hope they talked about that last night. They didn't? They did. I don't know. I didn't see it. I don't know. But nonetheless, they won the war thanks to Latino help. By the way, we financed the American War of Independence. Okay. Came time to write a constitution. 1787. They said, what were we fighting for? Oh, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, but we got slaves. They don't get life, they don't get liberty, they don't get the pursuit of happiness. Now, how do we square that up with the Declaration of Independence? We're writing this Constitution, it's kind of like the regulations. Well, they said, we got an idea. They're not people. different races may or may not be people. And obviously, if they're a different race, they're not created equally, so they don't get the life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. We can hold them in slavery. And so the most, at that point, the folks they were most accustomed to that were not people were African Americans and American Indians. So this country kind of got off a little bit on the wrong foot in saying civil rights, but not for everybody. Okay. 1810, Father Hidalgo stands up on the hill, rings the bell, and declares Mexico's independence from Spain. Like the American independence, Declaration of Independence, he said, well, actually, unlike it, he said very clearly, when we become independent of Spain, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to get rid of slavery. Slavery had been a Spanish colonial institution, and it was bitterly resented. He said, we're going to get rid of slavery. I'm going to free the slaves. I'm going to give the owners 10 days to free their slaves, and if they don't free them in 10 days, I can put the owners in jail. Very different from the Declaration of Independence that kind of waffled around, well, persons held in indenture and servitude. No, they're saying no slavery. And he said, we're going to provide civil rights for everyone, irrespective of their racial background. We don't care whether you're Indo, Afro, Ibero, Asiático, or any combination. You will be a citizen of the Republic of Mexico. And in fact, 2 months later, José María Morelos announced the formation of the new government of Mexico. And in it, he said, I publicly announce the establishment of the new government that will not label by calidad of Indian, mulatto, or any of these other castas, African, Chinese, etc., but rather all will be known generally as Americans. Not even Mexicans. Americans. Pues somos americanos todos, no? Right, so why not? Okay. Well, guess what? The West was part of Mexico. This was the law of the land. No slavery, civil rights, irrespective of racial background. A little bit different from the American Constitution, isn't it? That you got civil rights if you're white, and we can have slavery. So we had a couple of generations of Spanish speakers in the American West grew up, no slavery, civil rights. Along came the United States and its constitution. We love slavery, we don't like non-whites. You had a war, and when I was in high school, I was taught about the Mexican War. I remember the first time I went to Mexico City, I met my cousins, and they were students at UNAM, I was a student at Berkeley, and they talked about the North American invasion. Right? La invasión norteamericana. North America, you mean the Mexican War? You mean invasion? Who invaded whom? Huh? Okay. Well, you had that. The Treaty Guadalupe Hidalgo ended it, but it left a big tail in terms of civil rights, the issues of race and slavery. So what happened is on February 1st, 1848, out in California, about 10,000 citizens of the Republic of Mexico who fully represented the Indo-Afro-Ibero spectrum went to sleep as citizens of Mexico. At midnight, someone drew a border line down the northern half of Mexico. Those territories went over to possession of the United States. And the next morning, they woke up, and I can just see it. They're kind of yawning and stretching. They look around and suddenly, oh, my God, they're not Mexican citizens anymore. Now they're citizens of the United States. Still speaking Spanish, still eating frijoles, still eating tortillas. But now they're citizens of the United States. So they said, okay, no sense crying over spilt milk. They rolled up their sleeves. Let's build this new state of California. And so these Spanish speakers, former citizens of the Republic of Mexico, said, we're going to help to write the Constitución del Estado de California. Well, they also wrote a version in English, the California State Constitution. But you see, they'd been speaking Spanish for centuries. So the California State Constitution very clearly said, all laws, decrees, regulations, and provisions which from their nature require publication shall be published in English and Spanish. So we came in as a bilingual state. But that's not all. The former Mexicano said, by the way, we got rid of slavery about 30 years ago. We're not going to allow slavery in California. And the Constitution, okay, slavery is not permitted. Which, by the way, really offended the southern states. We came in as a free state, and they thought they could move that Missouri Compromise line all the way over to the Pacific Ocean. Suddenly, we blocked that. And we said, by the way, we need to allow non-whites to be citizens. Here is Pio Pico. He was the last Mexican governor of California. I mean, as you look at this photograph, did his ancestors come over on the Mayflower? No, clearly he's of Indian and African ancestry. But he was a citizen. And in many parts of the United States, he was not. just because of his answer. And in California, because that's the way it had been in Mexico, citizen irrespective of color. Well, as soon as that constitution, the ink on it was dry, they discovered gold. Well, you know, you hear all about the gold rush and the 49ers. Have you ever heard of any Spanish-speaking gold rush folks? No. Well, I've done the demographics. Turns out there's a huge immigration from Mexico, Central, and South America. They know about the gold. In fact, who knew how to dig gold and silver out of the ground? Folks from Mexico and Latin America have been doing it for 300 years. Tens of thousands walked up the old Camino del Diablo up to California to work the mines. Tens of thousands. Thousands more sailed from every port, from Guaymas in the north to Talcahuano in the south. And they came from all over Latin America. And by the way, almost every Latin American republic, as soon as they became independent, abolished slavery and provided civil rights for everyone, irrespective of racial background. Every single one. So they came, yes, many from Mexico, but they also came from Chile, they came from Argentina, they came from Peru, they came from Ecuador, from Bolivia, from Colombia, from Brazil, they came from Cuba, they came from El Salvador, from Guatemala, Nicaragua. They came from all over, and they were accustomed, except for the folks from Cuba and Brazil, no slavery. Well, Cuba and Brazil still had slavery, and civil rights for everyone. And they got to work because they knew how to find gold, they knew how to dig it out of the ground. And as soon as they got up there, they started Spanish language newspapers so they could communicate. The very first one began in 1851, La Estrella de Los Angeles. Then La Crónica up in San Francisco. Here's Clamor Público back in Los Angeles. Well, to begin with, they had, you know, they're digging money out of the ground. They were setting up businesses. They need to sell stuff to one another. So they were advertising their businesses. Here's a grocery store in Los Angeles, Los Garcias, 1857. Here's a hotel and restaurant, the Fonda y Posada up in San Francisco, Peruana y Mexicana. So I'm assuming one owner's from Peru, the other's from Mexico. They got their grub stake up in the gold country. They put their money together. And now they're on Pacific, right between Stockton and DuPont. You had musicians, you had singers, you had composers, you had orchestras, you had theater, you had opera, you had zarzuela. I mean, they had a whole life. Most important, you had people. Tens of thousands poured into California in the decade of the gold rush. Here are two of them. This is Ines Nunez, before she was de Mendoza, who actually walked up El Camino del Diablo. Here's Francisco Mendoza. He sailed. They met up in Tuolumne County, a town called Sonora in Tuolumne County. They fell in love. They got married. They built their house, and this house stood until 1970. They got torn down for a parking lot. And they had children, Isabel Maria Mendoza and Maria Rosaria Mendoza. Her great-grandchildren in my office were doing family histories, videotaping them. You know, in the histories that I was taught about the American West, basically after 1848, Latinos just kind of disappear from history, except for Joaquin Murieta or something like that, Juan Cortinas. You never hear of them. But I'm a demographer. I did the data. So here we have births in Los Angeles County, Latino births. And you notice that curve keeps going up. And here are the non-Hispanic white births for the first 20 years. But what's really interesting, those babies were very different from their parents, in that they were a second generation. Here's one of them right now. This is Reginaldo Francisco del Valle, born in 1854. Unlike his parents, he was a citizen the moment he was born, and he grew up and was bicultural and bilingual. Now, what did it mean to be bicultural during the gold rush? Well, here's the 16 de septiembre, Mexican Independence Day. It's been celebrated in California ever since 1822. Why give up a perfectly good holiday? And they have continued to celebrate, and they celebrate up until now, 212 years. But we're now citizens of the United States, so in addition to Fiestas Patrias Mexicanas, we add in El Cuatro de Julio, 4th of July. See, this is bicultural. You get two holidays for the price of one. Bilingual, one of the newspapers, El Clamor Público. Okay, you notice this page is in Spanish, but you turn the next page, and the next page is in English. Does this sound familiar? This all begins right after 1848. And one of these things these newspapers just couldn't get enough about is we're now part of the United States. We came from countries that had got rid of slavery and racial restrictions on citizenship, and suddenly we're plunged right in the middle of a country that's arguing about slavery and race. And we thought, wait a minute, didn't we get rid of this? And as you know, during the 1850s, the U.S. allowed slavery. There was an expansion of slavery. You know, you can go through all of that. The Compromise of 1850, Kansas-Nebraska Act. I mean, the slave states were furious about the admission of California as a free state. We upset the balance of the Missouri Compromise. They got the Fugitive Slave Act, you name it. Meanwhile, Latinos could just look right across the border. Benito Juarez rewrote Mexican Constitution in 1857. He wrote the Constitution of Reforma and reaffirmed Mexico's abolition of slavery. And it said, slavery will not be permitted in any part of the Mexican Republic. Very different from the U.S. Constitution. Oh, local rule, let the states decide, persons held in involuntary servitude. No, Mexico said no slavery. And then, interesting, the Fugitive Slave Act that the slave states had exacted. Interesting, Mexican Constitution says slaves from other countries. What other countries could they be thinking about? The United States. Okay. Slaves from other countries will be free by the act of national territory. You've heard of the Underground Railroad. One of the biggest branches ran south into Mexico. Once they got across the Rio Grande, they were free forever. They could stop worrying about the slave catcher sneaking up on them in the back of the night. The other thing that Latinos just couldn't understand is how the U.S. Constitution would deny civil rights to non-whites. Remember the Dred Scott decision? Basically, the Supreme Court said to Dred Scott, an African-American, you're not white, you have no rights, period. Can you imagine what Governor Pio Pico was thinking at this point? My God, I'm black. I thought I was a citizen. Now they're going to take this away from me? Wait, what's going on? The 1857 Constitution of Mexico reaffirms, no civil or political distinction shall be made for reason of birth, nor origin, nor race. Two very different constitutional systems. Well, the U.S. constitutional system tore itself apart. The southern states, fearful that Lincoln wouldn't vigorously enough defend slavery and white supremacy, decided the only way to protect those institutions, leave the United States, set up a brand new country, and their constitution will protect forever slavery and white supremacy. And the Civil War erupted. Well, at this point, back west, we have a whole new generation of Spanish language newspapers. Latinos knew everything about what was going on in the Civil War. When we had this first iconic battle between ironclad ships, well, out west, Latinos were reading about buques blindados, El Monitor, La Merrimac. They knew every detail. They knew how thick the armor was. They knew how many shots were fired. They knew everything. When the Emancipation Proclamation became law of the land in 1863, Latinos were able to read it in Spanish. And most of them said, well, it's about time, we did this 50 years ago. What took you so long? And the question came up, oh, now it's North versus South, United States versus the Confederates. Which side would Latinos support? Well, what do you think? If you're a Latino, you think, okay, what is the Confederacy fighting for? To maintain slavery, we got rid of that now 50 years ago. The Confederacy's fighting to maintain racial equality, we got rid of that 50 years ago. The Confederacy's fighting to maintain elitist rule, we got rid of that. We got democracy, we got republics. And so Latinos, particularly out in Nevada, California, Oregon, said, hey, we're going to support freedom and democracy. We're supporting the North. And they did. Not just with words, but with troops. Many Spanish-speaking units were formed. They had Spanish-speaking cavalry. This is Major Jose Ramon Pico. Those of you from L.A., remember Pico Boulevard, north of the middle of town? Okay, them Picos. Okay. Here he's seeking volunteers for his company of Spanish-speaking Native California cavalry. Raised four companies, they rode off to war. New Mexico had Spanish-speaking cavalry under Major Rafael Chaco, and you had a lot of Latinos involved. Two Latinos won the Medal of Honor during the American Civil War. Heck, the first admiral, the first full admiral of the United States Navy was a bilingual, bicultural Latino, David Farragut. I know they pronounce it Farragut back in Washington, Farragut, it's a Catalan name. Because Latinos think, well, if the Confederates win with their slavery and denial of civil rights to non-whites, we're goners. We have got to back Lincoln. We have no choice. We want freedom and democracy for ourselves and our children. And of course, from the first battle of Bull Run, guess what? The Confederates won, and the United States lost. And in battle after battle after battle, it seemed like every time there's a major battle between the North and South, they read again, Confederate victories, Union defeats. And the Confederacy expanded out, took over New Mexico, Arizona. There at the Colorado River, the next stop was the port of Los Angeles. They're going to get back that Missouri Compromise line by force of arms. So at this point, Mexico now shares a 1,500-mile border with the Confederacy. The United States is trying to blockade. Oops. Let's go backwards. The United States is trying to blockade the Confederates. It was hard. And the Confederates thought, well, you know, blockade, you know, if we could just get this guy Juarez to play ball with us, we can run troops, we can run supplies, ship cotton back the other way, earn money. We don't need to worry about the blockade. So they went to Juarez, said, hey, will you play ball with us? Hello, Juarez had written the 1857 Constitution. Oh, you guys are fighting for slavery, and you want to deny civil rights to non-whites? Good luck. I'm not playing ball with you. So the Confederates began raiding into Mexico. I didn't like that, and Latinos were asking, oh my God, could things possibly get any worse? Now the Confederacy is threatening to go into Mexico. And I have to change decks here because my decks get so big because of these pictures, but I love these pictures, don't you? Okay. Of course, now if you studied rhetoric, this is a rhetorical question. The only obvious answer to that is, of course, they're going to get worse. Why would I ask the question? The question is, how do they get worse? Well, at this point, the Confederacy is riding high. The Confederacy is now threatening Mexico because they want an access to goods. Enter Napoleon III, Emperor of the French. Now, Napoleon was also a friend of the Confederacy. He loved the Confederates. Here we have a political cartoon. Here's Napoleon John Bull. Here's Jeff Davis beating up on Abraham Lincoln, whose arms are tied by the Constitution. Napoleon III would have loved to have seen the U.S. divided, and he figured that way they'd never be any competition to France. And he carried on a long flirtation with the Confederacy. Many French banks floated huge bonds to make the Confederate dollar worth anything. So Napoleon III, looking at this, says, here are my buds, the Confederates, and if they could just get somebody to play ball with them in Mexico, we could stop worrying about a blockade. I have an idea. What if we got rid of this President Juarez? What if we got rid of this Constitution of 1857? What if we put in a monarchy, the only true way to govern, and he can make nice with the Confederates? So that was his plan, among other things. So he sends his troops to Mexico, and they leave their strongholds in Veracruz and Orizaba, and they start marching towards Mexico. Now, this is early spring 1862. Things have still been going very badly for the Union. They are about 3 days' march away from Mexico City without encountering much opposition, and this is just about the time that McClellan starts to launch his ill-fated disaster in the Peninsula Campaign, and Robert E. Lee just wipes him out. But before they get to Mexico City, before they can link up with the Confederates, they have to go through a little town called Puebla. Puebla, we've heard of it. Isn't that what they celebrate on Cinco de Mayo? Battle of Puebla. But why is it so important here when they don't celebrate it in Mexico? Well, on the morning of May 5th, the French troops went charging in. And of course, Latinos think, oh my God, is it all over? It took 3 weeks for news to get from Puebla to Mexico City to Acapulco on the steamer up to San Francisco, then onto the Spanish language newspapers and spread throughout the West. And they opened up the newspaper 3 weeks later, and the headlines were, Viva Mexico! Viva Zaragoza! Against all possible odds, the Mexican army threw back the French troops at Puebla, and they were inoperative for almost a year. Well, the way this was interpreted, remember, up here, we thought, my God, they're going to link up with the Confederates. This war is over, and what's going to happen to me and my kids? It was, wow, finally, this is the first major victory for the Army of Freedom and Democracy. Now, it happened to be at Puebla. It certainly wasn't at the gates of Richmond, where the Army of Freedom and Democracy just got beat. And there were spontaneous celebrations of the victory at the Battle of Puebla in California. Notice this was dateline May 22nd, 1862, 3 weeks after the news had just gotten there in the mining town of Columbia up in Tuolumne County, where they're celebrating our triumph over the French that we have celebrated with cannon salutes and banquets. And it just energized Latinos. It would be kind of like if, you know, El Paso Community College basketball beat UCLA 50-20 or something. They're just, wow, we did it. We had no idea we could do it, but we did it. Just imagine what a shot that would give the alumni. So Latinos are just really overjoyed. Finally, we're doing it. We got to help. So here we have three Latinos in Los Angeles during the Civil War. These two are Mexican immigrants. He's a Californio. And they're so happy about the news they received. We'd like to help Juarez, but he's 1,500 miles away. How do we possibly help Juarez? Then somebody said, by the way, you guys are digging gold and silver now out of the ground. You have money. You could send remesas, to Juarez so he could buy munitions of war. So yeah, we could. So they formed community-based organizations called Juntas Patrióticas Mexicanas, and every month the members would give their donations. A dollar was the average daily wage back then to be equivalent to $100 today, every month, to send to Juarez. And because these lists were published in the Spanish language newspapers, we have put all these names on a database. And as we look at unduplicated counts, we toss out all the, because many people were giving every month for 4.5 years. There were 129 locations, 122 in California, 6 in Nevada, and 1 up in Oregon. Oops, missed up in Walla Walla. Or not Walla, in the Dalles. Every month sending money to Juarez. And in fact, they had almost 14,000 members. Now, this is when the total Latino population of California and Nevada was about 100,000, which wasn't small. Today, if we were to scope this out over the Latino population in this country, that'd be close to 20 million members. Just think, we had a 20 million member Latino organization with everyone donating $100 a month dues. You know what that organization could do? I mean, there's nothing it couldn't do. They did it during the Civil War. And not only did they allude to the Battle of Puebla and the Cinco de Mayo every time these groups met every month, every year from then on, they initiated formally organized public celebrations as a public statement as to where Latinos stood on the issues of the Civil War. So the following year, up in Camp Calaveritas, up in the Gold Country, here was a Cinco de Mayo. Here in Los Angeles, a Cinco de Mayo saying, here's where we stand. We oppose slavery, we support freedom. We oppose white supremacy, we support racial equality. We oppose elitist forms of government, we support democracy. And they were celebrating Cinco de Mayo in Stockton, just declared bankruptcy 150 years later. They were celebrating Cinco de Mayo in San Francisco. They were celebrating Cinco de Mayo in the little mining town of Hornitos up in Mariposa County. Cinco de Mayo in San Andres in Amador County up in the Gold Country. Cinco de Mayo in Sutter Creek, also up in the Gold Country. Cinco de Mayo in Virginia City, Nevada, Silver Country, the Comstock Silver Mine at that point. Cinco de Mayo in the mine of New Almaden. They're celebrating Cinco de Mayo in Marysville and in Stockton and all the way down to Santa Ana every single year as a public statement. Here's where we stand in this great American Civil War. And although these were called Juntas Patrióticas Mexicanas, they weren't just for Mexicans. Because remember, you'd had all these immigrants from all over Latin America. They supported the ideals of no slavery and racial equality. So that one of the officers in San Francisco was a Chileno, Felipe Fierro. In Los Angeles, actually, the president was a Colombiano, Pio Quinto Dávila. And up in the mining town of Hornitos, the secretary was a Salvadoreño, Juan Vicente Martorell. But it wasn't about country of origin. It was about, do you support these values which all Latin American countries supported? So much so that in a speech, one of the speakers said, in this land, when we say Hispanic American, we don't notice where someone was born, but rather we embrace each other as brothers and sisters. And there was a Tejano, California connection in all of this. Remember, they're reading about the Civil War every single day in Spanish. Juan Cortinas was widely celebrated. He was a war hero in California during the Civil War. Why? When the Civil War broke out in Texas. Now remember, Texas was part of the Confederacy, but a lot of Latinos, in fact, most Latinos supported the Union. So Cortinas took his army to the Mexico side, and he actually wound up, he fought a doubleheader battle one in September of 1864. He was fighting, actually, the French right south of the river, but the Confederates on the other side of the river, so they were firing at Cortinas because the French were kind of their buddies. Cortinas got mad, so he whipped the French, he splashed across the river, he beat the Confederates, went into Brownsville and raised the U.S. flag, then went back into Mexico. And all over California, when news of this, people were just so happy. They had parades and celebrations about Cortinas. They had a parade in San Francisco honoring Cortinas. In Los Angeles, this guy, Filomeno Ibarra, gave a speech honoring Cortina in the Rio Grande. And in Jackson, Amador County, our valiant General Cortina was honored. And in Sonora, that mining town, also Cortina, General Cortina arrived. So you had very close communication. People knew what was going on. Because for Latinos, it was one war with two fronts, a front against the Confederates and a front against the French. And we'll go into the families. Here we have Dr. Platon Vallejo, who is the first Latino U.S. medical graduate. See, prior to him, the medical folks had gone to school in Mexico City. He was the first one. He was born in California to go to U.S. medical school. He went to Columbia in New York, and he graduated in the middle of the Civil War, and he was a surgeon for the Union Army. He was there at the Second Battle of Bull Run. His other brother, Uladislao, went south. He joined the Mexican Army. He was a captain of the Mexican Army. He was part of President Juarez's personal bodyguard. And their father, General Mariano Vallejo, was proud to say, "My sons are defending freedom and democracy all over the North American continent." When Lincoln had to run for re-election in 1864, it wasn't clear he was going to win. In fact, if you remember, he was so afraid he was going to lose, he actually wrote his letter to his successor, and he made his cabinet sign it. They didn't know what it said, but he's saying, "Look, here's what I tried to do. Good luck." So Latino said, "No, we've got to finish this war." Remember, there was a peace party with General McClellan as a peace candidate saying, "Let the South go, let them keep their slaves, let them keep their white supremacy. This is not worth it." Latino said, "No, we bet too much." I love this campaign announcement, "Para Presidente Abraham Lincoln," and look at the flags that illustrate vote for Lincoln. The Mexican flag and the U.S. flag, because those are the flags of freedom and democracy. Well, not simply because of Latino support, but among other things with Latino support, finally, Lincoln was reelected. The Civil War was brought to an end. Finally, in 1865, the Confederates had to lay down their arms. 2 years later, the Emperor, Maximilian I of Mexico, was captured at the Siege of Querétaro. He was tried, sentenced, and executed. And finally, after nearly six continuous years of war, Latinos were able to breathe a sigh of relief that they and their children and grandchildren would live as citizens, equal before the eyes of the law, irrespective of being from Indo or Afro or Ibero-America. I hope they cover this in that PBS series. Because if they don't, they've left out something very important. Because we took a stance for civil rights. That was the Latin American stance. Well, today, Cinco de Mayo is probably the best, the most widely celebrated Latino event. Millions of people will celebrate it. But you know, you can go to any one of these celebrations and ask them, "But why are we celebrating? Mexican Independence Day? No. The beer companies? No. We have forgotten why we celebrate Cinco de Mayo. We forgot that it was rooted in the American Civil War and on stances on civil rights. So quite often it's become Drinco de Mayo." But this came way late into the game. Or even worse in these Tea Party times, it's seen as a foreign, un-American holiday. This is from one of these Tea Party websites that sees Cinco de Mayo as un-American. In fact, this guy is saying, "It should be celebrated in their country, not in America." What? "A lot of illegals celebrate it here in America. I would like to see a law, no promoting Cinco de Mayo in America. Anyone celebrates this on May 5th in any American city or town faces a fine of $500 plus 5 days in jail." Okay, don't get mad. Teaching moment. First of all, what grade would you give him in American history? Yeah. I mean, is it celebrated in Mexico? No. Its origins in the American Civil War. That's why it should be celebrated here. But I'm sure you remember what happened about a month ago. Poor Sebastian de la Cruz. Born here, his dad's a Navy veteran. He sings the national anthem. Suddenly, all this, my God. I mean, I'm sure you've seen a lot of these tweets. This is one of them. "No disrespect, but a Mexican kid signing, can't even spell singing, okay. English only, right? Singing the national anthem makes it un-American. A Mexican sings it, makes it un-American. We picked up arms to defend civil rights, to defend this country. As Mexicans, as Latinos, de Estados Unidos, because we came from that tradition. Not because we assimilated, not because we learned about slavery from the U.S. Constitution. We had our own constitutional traditions that allowed us to make that choice. So this is why we need to inform this person. Well, guess what? This is an old history. And we were doing it 81 years before Jamestown. Last year was the 150th anniversary of the Battle of Puebla. I had been doing some historic demographic research. One of my data sources were these Spanish language newspapers, because they would publish the births and the marriages and the deaths that the English language papers just didn't bother to announce. Does this sound familiar? So they were my data source. But as I was just looking at the births, marriages, and deaths, I would start to see, oh my God, the Dred Scott decision. This is in Spanish in the columns. Oh my God, John Brown marches on Harper's Ferry. Oh my God, the Confederate guns fire on the Fort Sumter. Oh my God, the French troops land at Veracruz. And I was reading in real time these events I've just shared with you. And I thought, you know what? I need to share this in a written form for the 150th anniversary. So I wrote this book, El Cinco de Mayo, An American Tradition. And that subtitle catches. No, it's Mexican, isn't it? Oh, would you like to know the true history? And I wrote, it actually came out, I was on very short, very tight deadline, got it out in time. It came out 2 weeks before the Cinco de Mayo last year. We took over this museum and we put together an exhibit, a professionally curated exhibit, just shared all of this in course, typically museum style, titled Latinos in California Respond to the Civil War. Then I decided, you know, we need to recreate these original Cinco de Mayo, because right now we always think of mariachis and dancing Adelitas. I wanted to recreate what were these original Cinco de Mayo like during the Civil War. And they wouldn't have had mariachi music because mariachis hadn't been invented in the Civil War. What music did they use to celebrate? And luckily, these newspaper accounts would tell me what songs they played. What did they wear? Not the dancing Adelitas, that's from La Revolución. What were their dances like? So we recreated the original Cinco de Mayo. And you notice no dancing Adelitas. In fact, we have photographs of Latinos in Los Angeles who participated in Cinco de Mayo. Each one of these dancers, actors, actually takes a person. This is the clothing that that person wore. We have their speeches that they gave, so we recite parts of their speeches, not the whole things. And here's the whole company. Then we did a coloring book, because I wanted young kids, who aren't going to go through a university press book, to start to at least get images of, wow, Latinos fighting the Civil War in the East and in Mexico. We even have a Facebook page where we talk about this. And of course, we are close to Hollywood, so of course, we've got to be doing our own documentary. We're in post-production. So let me just bring this back to what I started with. This gentleman, I was one of the few English-speaking people there. The papers were in Spanish. He doesn't understand that he was witnessing 500 years of Latino medical presence in what's now the United States. That's what he saw. It wasn't illegal immigrants necessarily. He was viewing history that includes our wars of independence, our stance on the Civil War, and what we have done virtually every single day. So just this is your mnemonic device to remember the 500 years, and whenever people start to question, you know, why are you speaking Spanish? This is America. Oh, we were speaking Spanish here 81 years before English. Okay, it's all good. Just remember that Cinco de Mayo is not a Mexican holiday. It's an American Civil War holiday created by Latinos de Estados Unidos, by Latinos living on this side. It's about 500 years, and we're seeing the tag end of it now. This is the pre-med group at UCLA. They're called the Latino Health, Student Health Project. They go down to Tecate every quarter. They love it. The National Hispanic Medical Association is part of this. The Latino Medical Student Association, you should have a chapter here. Do you not? Okay. This is the graduation at UCLA just a couple of years ago. But when I look at them, and I look at that first medical library that arrived in San Juan de los Caballos, I see a direct line, unbroken, undiminished, there from then till today. So I think we can truthfully say, not only viva el Cinco de Mayo, but que viva civil rights. Thank you very much.
Dr. David Hayes Bautista, author of El Cinco de Mayo, An American Tradition. Now, I bet you, having listened to this exposition, you have an entirely different view about the role Mexican Americans played in the early civil rights movement. And this is a history that just is not reported very, very widespread. It's just not. So I want to thank you so much for listening. And thank you for staying tuned. Coming up next, Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. And it's always a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company. So enjoy El Cinco de Mayo as a far more enlightened person today. Bye-bye.